You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 83 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Tension Between East and West, 10 Lectures, translated by B.A. Rowley. This is Lecture 5, entitled Anthroposophy and Cosmology, given in Vienna on June 5th, 1922. Nowadays, if you start to discuss with someone who is interested in these matters, the possibility of achieving a knowledge of spiritual life in conjunction with the sensory physical world, you will generally meet with a sympathetic reception. At any rate, the question will be raised, are there paths by which man can reach some kind of spiritual knowledge, even though it may often turn out that the only knowledge of a spiritual world allowed is one that takes the form of general concepts and ideas, a vague pantheism, perhaps, or a conception of life reminiscent of mysticism. If, however, you should then attempt, as it became necessary for me to do in my book titled An Outline of Occult Science, Readers Aside, also known as An Outline of Esoteric Science, End of Readers Aside, to describe a real cosmology, a science of the origin and evolution of the world in specific terms, discussion with an enlightened person is usually at an end. He reacts strongly to the suggestion that anyone today might be in a position, on some epistemological basis or other, to make a statement about a spiritual origin of the world, about forces operating spiritually in world evolution, and about the possibility that this evolution, after having passed through a sensory physical phase, might lead back once more into a spiritual form of existence. The reaction of the enlightened person to such a suggestion, implicit in the specific descriptions in title Occult Science, for example, is to avoid having anything to do with someone who makes claims of this kind. He will think, if someone sets out to make specific statements about such matters, he is probably on the verge of losing his mind. At the very least, we cannot compromise ourselves by becoming involved in discussing these details. It is naturally impossible, in a single lecture, to present any details of cosmology as they follow from the worldview I am advocating. Instead, I should like today to try and show you how spiritual science can arrive at a cosmology and a knowledge of the spiritual impulses underlying world evolution. The reproach, usually leveled at anyone who now attempts such a task, is that he is guilty of anthropomorphism, of taking features of human soul life and projecting them in accordance with his wishes or some other predilections or prejudices, onto the cosmos. A closer examination of the way in which the worldview presented here attains its cosmological results, however, should be enough to demonstrate that there cannot be the slightest question of anthropomorphism. On the contrary, this worldview seeks its conclusions about the world and world evolution through a spiritual cognition that is just as objective as the scientific study of nature. You will have gathered from the lectures I have given so far what the view of the world I am advocating aims at in its research methods. On the one hand, it desires to preserve everything that humanity has acquired over the last 3 or 4 centuries in scientific conscientiousness and a sure and careful method of seeking truth. In particular, this view of life certainly does not wish to exceed the limits of natural knowledge, insofar as this is appropriate, but to observe carefully where the limits of purely natural knowledge are located. The existence of such limits is much discussed today, and has been for a long time. We can say that the opinions of trained natural scientists on this subject today are founded on notions that more philosophically inclined minds derive from Kant and other minds, to whom a more popular treatment appeals, from Schopenhauer and others. A great deal of material in this direction could be cited. Now, it is probably true to say that Kant and Schopenhauer, and all those who follow in their wake, are dangerous guides to the discernment of the limits of natural knowledge, because these thinkers very enticingly, I would say, stopped short at a certain point in their consideration of the human cognitive faculty and the capacities of the human soul. They drew the line at a certain point, and their approach to this point is extraordinarily shrewd. Yet the fact remains that as soon as we become aware of the need to consider man as a whole, and to take into account all that can follow from man's physical and spiritual organism in the form of cognitive activity and inner experience, we shall also realize that a one-sided critique of the cognitive faculty can only lead to one-sided conclusions. If we wish to examine the relation of man to the world, in order to establish whether there is a path that leads from man to knowledge of the world, we must take him as a whole and consider him in his entire being. It is from this point of view that I should now like to raise the question. Assuming that the limits of our knowledge of nature, which scientists have also been discussing since Dubois-Raymond, though they are viewed very differently today from the way he saw them half a century ago, did not exist, what would be man's position in the world? If we were to assume that man's theoretical cognitive faculty, by which he connects his concepts with observations, and the results of experiments, in order to arrive at the laws of the universe, could also penetrate without difficulty into the organic realm, could advance as far as life, then there would be little reason why it should stop short of the higher modes of existence, the realms of soul and spirit. If we were to assume, therefore, that the ordinary consciousness we employ in the sciences and work with in ordinary life were able at all times not only to approach the outside of life, but also to penetrate below the surface of things to their inner being, that is, if there were thus no limits to knowledge, what sort of constitution would man need? Well, his relation to the world would be such that his entire being, his inmost being, would be constantly entering into everything with its spiritual antenna. Though this may appear paradoxical to some people, a dispassionate observer of life and of the relationship of man to the world will realize a being whose ordinary everyday consciousness had no limits would inevitably lack the capacity to love. And if we reflect on the significance of this capacity for our whole life, and on what we are in life because we can love, we shall conclude, on this mortal earth we should not be human beings, in the sense in which we must, in fact, be human beings, if we did not have love. But love demands that we should meet another individual, whatever realm of nature it may belong to, as self-contained individuals. We must not invade this other individual with our clear and lucid thinking. On the contrary, at the very moment when we develop love, our being must become active, that part of us which is beyond clear and lucid concepts. The moment we were to become capable of invading the other individual with clear and lucid concepts, love would die. Since the human being must be a creature of love, by virtue of his task on earth, and since when he has a certain capacity it conditions his whole being, we can conclude the human being definitely needs limits to his knowledge of the outer world and must not penetrate beyond them if, within his ordinary consciousness, he is to fulfill his task here on earth. The property that enables him to be a creature of love has its obverse side in his ordinary knowledge, which has to stop at the limit that is set for us, in order that we may be creatures capable of love. This is just an outline that each individual can fill out for himself. Even so, it reveals something that has certain consequences. It shows, for example, that we must go forward from the premises of Kantian philosophy and look at man as a whole, as he stands in life as a living being. This is the first thing that the view of the world I am advocating has to say about the limits of scientific knowledge, and we shall be hearing more about them. Here is one of the two guiding principles for any view of life and the world that is to be taken seriously today. The other, to which I have already drawn attention in the last few days, can be described by saying, any view of life and the world that is to be taken seriously today must not lose itself in nebulous mysticism. It is a fact that even noble minds at the present time, observing that natural science is limited and cannot provide us with a springboard into the spiritual world, throw themselves into the arms of mysticism, especially the older forms of humanity's mystical striving. Yet in face of the other requirements for knowledge today, this certainly cannot be the right way. Mysticism seeks, by looking within man, to reach the actual foundations of existence. But once again, human knowledge is limited when it comes to looking within man. Assuming that man were capable of looking into himself without limit, to the point where the deepest essence of human nature is revealed, where man is in touch with the eternal springs of existence and links his personal existence with that of the cosmos, what would a human being then have to do without? Those who gain great inner satisfaction from mysticism often summon up the most varied things from within themselves. I have already indicated that what is brought up in this way ultimately turns out, on closer examination by a true student of the soul, to rest on some external observation. This observation sinks into subconscious depths, is permeated by feeling and will and organic processes, and then appears again in an altered form. Anything observed can undergo a transformation or metamorphosis so great that the mystic will believe he is drawing from the depths of his soul something that must demonstrate the eternal foundations of the soul itself. Even such outstanding mystics as Meister Eckhart or Johannes Tauler are not completely free from the error that creeps in when we mistake the altered inner pictures of ordinary consciousness for independent revelations of the human soul. Objective reflection on this state of affairs, however, enables us to answer the question, what would man have to do without, if in ordinary consciousness, he could see right into himself at any moment? He would have to do without something that is essential for the well-ordered existence of our soul, an inwardly coherent faculty of memory. For what is the relation of this faculty of memory to the claims of mysticism? What I am now going to outline in a rather popular way, I could also present quite scientifically. But we only need an explanation, and this can be conveyed in popular terms. When we observe the outside world and inwardly transform what we experience there as whole human beings, so that it can later reappear as memory, the spiritual result of our external observation actually falls on something like a mirror within us. This is a comparison, but at the same time, it is more than a comparison. Impressions from outside cannot be allowed to stimulate us so much that we carry them down into our deepest self. It must be possible for outside stimuli to be reflected. Our organism, our being must behave like a reflecting device. Ought we, then, to break through this reflecting device in order to reach what lies behind the mirror? That is what the mystic is trying to do, without knowing it. But we need our reliable, well-ordered memory. If there are any gaps in it, as far back into our childhood as we can remember, we shall fall victim to pathological mental states. Man must be so constituted that he retains the experiences that come from outside. He cannot therefore be so constituted that he can penetrate directly into his deepest self. If we make the mystic's attempt to penetrate into our innermost self with ordinary consciousness, we shall only reach the reflecting device. And it is right, from the point of view of our humanity, that we should there come up against the inner thought pictures we have absorbed from outside. Here again, we must look at the whole man, as he needs to be, if he is to possess a memory, in order to see that mysticism is impossible for ordinary consciousness. There are thus two limits to ordinary consciousness: a limit of natural knowledge, in relation to the outer physical sensory world, and a limit in relation to mystical striving. And it is precisely from a clear insight into these two limits that there can in turn arise that other striving I have described here as befitting a modern seeking of the spiritual world. I mean the striving to draw from the soul dormant powers of cognition, so that by attaining a different form of consciousness, we can see into the spiritual world. With the kinds of knowledge I have been speaking of in the last few days, we can look at man as a being capable of love, and as a being capable of memory. When we do so, we will recognize that ordinary consciousness, operating through the senses, the intellect, and the faculty of thinking, must come to a halt before the outer world. For it is only by treating itself as an instrument for ordering the outer world that it can become capable of developing further and evolving that living thinking of which I have spoken in previous lectures. When, by means of this living thinking, we examine what happens in us as we stand before nature, we find that at the very moment when we have developed our faculty of thinking to the point where it provides a means of ordering external phenomena, our ordinary consciousness is extinguished in the act of cognition. However clear our consciousness is up to a certain point in a given process of knowing nature, at this point, it really goes over in part into a state of sleep, into the subconscious. Why is this? It is because at this point there must come into activity the faculty that pours out something more than abstract thinking into the world around us, one that carries our being out into it. For inasmuch as we love, our relationship to the world around us is not one of cognition, but one of reality, a real relationship of being. Only by developing living thinking are we able to carry over our experience into the reality of things. We pour out our living thoughts, follow up the beginnings of spiritual life that exist outside in the form of spiritual world rhythm and appearance, and by cultivating empty consciousness, as I have described, advance further and further into the spiritual world, which is linked with the physical sensory world. Compared with ordinary consciousness, we feel in such a supersensible act of cognition as if we have been awakened from sleep. In a way, we eavesdrop on our being as it becomes a living being. Here is something that can make a more shattering impression on the spiritual seeker than anything he can obtain by repeating the experience of the profoundest mystic. More moving than the latter's absorption in his inner self is the moment of realizing that at a certain moment of higher cognition, man must pour out his own self as being into the outside world, and that the act of cognition transforms mere knowledge into real life, into a real togetherness with the outside world. At first, however, this is linked with an appreciable intensification of the sense of self. What happens is something like this. In ordinary cognition of the outer world, our I, capital, goes as far as the frontiers of nature. Here the I is pushed back. We feel surrounded on all sides by soul walls, so to speak. This in turn has repercussions on the sense of self. The sense of self has its own strength, and it achieves the right nuance precisely through the fact that along with this feeling of something like confinement, there is intermingled that self-surrender to the world and its creatures that comes of love. In supersensible cognition, the self is made even stronger, and there is, we may say, a danger that it will transform the love that rightfully exists on earth into a selfish submersion in things, that it will insert and push itself into things. By so doing, the self will expand. That is why in my book, titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment, I attach so much weight to the preparatory exercises. These exercises are aimed at self-discipline in relation to the sense of self and at helping us to develop the necessary capacity for love in ordinary life and ordinary consciousness before attempting to move into the supersensible world by means of higher knowledge. We must be healthy in soul, body, and spirit in this respect before we can enter the spiritual world in a way that is healthy. If we are, then no one will be able to raise the more or less Philistine objection that there is something uncomfortable about listening in on our own capacity for love. To do so makes a shattering impression, it is true. We see ourselves as never before in ordinary consciousness. What we attain in higher cognition, however, does not incorporate itself into the memory. If it did, we should be capable of marching through life fondly contemplating our own capacity for love, which would make us inadequate as people. And remembering this, you will know how to properly value these demands on supersensible knowledge. This characterizes the relation of supersensible knowledge to the capacity for love from an intellectual standpoint. But what do we experience as a result of it? It is clear from what I have said already that we pour out our intensified self into our surroundings. In this way, the self moves forward to the spiritual sphere. And we now come up against the curious fact that by making ourselves increasingly capable of entering into the outer world, we actually arrive at knowledge of our soul and our spiritual nature. Goethe's instinct in rejecting the knowledge of self that results from brooding introspection was, I would say, a healthy one. He had harsh things to say about this kind of mystical self-knowledge. Man can attain true self-knowledge only if, by strengthening his otherwise dormant powers of knowledge, he attains the capacity to explore with his self the outer world. It is in the world outside that man finds his real knowledge of self. We must learn to reach a true knowledge of the world in the modern sense by turning many familiar concepts almost back to front. And so it is with the concept of self-knowledge. Look into the world, seek ever further in the expanse by allowing the capacity of your eye to immerse itself in this expanse, strengthened by the development of cognitive powers. Then you will find your real self. We can therefore say, the cosmos allows us to penetrate it in order to gain supersensible knowledge. And what it gives back to us as a result of this penetration is precisely our self-knowledge. Let us look at this other aspect of experience, which is sometimes sought by a false mystical path. I have shown how the human will can be developed and how it is possible to develop dormant powers. The will can be developed to such an extent that the whole man becomes a kind of sense organ, or rather spirit organ, becomes, that is, as transparent in soul and spirit as the human eye, EYE, is transparent. We need only recall how selfless, in a material sense, the human eye must be to act as the organ of sight. If the eye were to fill itself with self-assertive material, our field of vision would at once grow dim. Our entire human nature must come to be like this, on the spiritual plane. Our entire being, soul and spirit, must become transparent. Then, with what lives in our will, we can enter the spiritual world even during our earthly existence. There now occurs, however, what I already hinted at yesterday. By seeing the spiritual world, we are enabled to comprehend our inner self. And as I explained yesterday, when as physical sensory beings we confront the outer world, we enter into its sensory physical phenomena with our entire being, and carry away with us memory images. Indeed, our soul is made up of these images. We can say, therefore, what is physical sensory outside is seen as image within. Conversely, I would say, in attaining the capacity to look out through the spirit organ that is our self into the outer world as into a spiritual world with spiritual beings and events, we perceive our own inner physical body. We learn to know the substance of our lungs, heart, and other organs. The spirituality of the outer world is reflected by the physical nature within us, just as the physical outer world is reflected by our spiritual abstract nature. But the path thus opened up to us, that of learning to know ourselves by contemplating the outer world, turns out to be a very concrete one. We come to know the place of the individual organs within the whole being of man. Gradually, we learn to perceive the harmony between the individual processes in these organs. The first discovery we make is as follows. What the mystic fishes for in his murky waters turns out, ultimately, to be transformed memories. But the memories often contain an admixture of something produced by an organic activity. He doesn't know this, of course. He believes that he is piercing the internal mirror that underlies memory. He is not piercing it. The processes of our organic being beat like waves upon the other side of the mirror. The mystic is not aware of what is really going on. He is only aware of a change in the memories that are reflected. Without being guilty of Philistinism in the process, we are forced to take much that appears beautiful, poetic, and mystical, and reduce it to something prosaic, saying, much that this or that mystic has drawn up from his soul in this way is not the expression of spiritual existence, but only a consequence of the surge of inner organic processes. Wonderful mystical accounts of ancient and recent times, from which those who take pleasure in such things can gain an extraordinarily poetic impression, are, in the last analysis, for anyone who can see things objectively, no more than the expression of inner processes in human nature itself. It seems Philistine to have to say, something mystical makes its appearance, it strikes us as poetic, and yet to anyone who understands, it represents the effect of certain vital processes on memories. For the serious seeker, it does not become entirely valueless on that account, for what makes something true does not have to do with whether it is presented in a way that pleases the narrow mind, but rather in the fact that a genuine attempt is being made to get nearer to the root of the matter. Whoever does not remain stuck, like the nebulous mystic, in ordinary consciousness, but rather, after first ensuring the health of his soul by means of preparatory exercises that emphasize the formation of a healthy memory, pierces this mirror of memory and really looks into himself, will see there the effects of wide-ranging processes originating in the spiritual outer world and continuing still in the spiritual world. In this way, we come to know man, and to say to ourselves what the abstract idealist may regard as something base in man because he is looking at it only physiologically or anatomically from the outside, that is, man's inner organization, is a wonderful result of the entire cosmos. And when we really come to know this inner organization, this is what we discover. When we look into our soul's inner realm and go back in memory over much that we have experienced in life, we can then, from what we revive within us at the right moment, conjure up these experiences before our spiritual eye, EYE, if only as shadows. From the image content, our soul has absorbed from the outer world, we can once again conjure up this world before our soul in a way that satisfies us. If we also learn to know our comprehensive inner organism, and learn how its individual parts are spiritually derived from the cosmos, our entire being, as we now perceive it, will present itself as a record of cosmic memories. We look into ourselves, not now with the eye, EYE, of the nebulous mystic, but with an awakened eye of the soul, and can perceive the nature of our lungs, our heart, the whole of the rest of our organism, looked at spiritually, inwardly. All this presents itself to us as a memory of the world, recorded in man, just as our memory of the life between birth and the present is recorded in the soul. There now appears in us what we can call knowledge of man as a memory of the world, a reflection of world evolution, of events in the cosmos. The first thing to do is to familiarize yourselves with the detailed exercises that must be undertaken before man arrives at such a self-knowledge. Not the brooding self-knowledge of ordinary introspection, as it is called, but the self-knowledge that sees in each of our internal organs something like a combination of spiritual elements resulting from certain spiritual processes in the cosmos. Once they have understood this aspect of man, people will no longer accuse us of anthropomorphically transposing what is in our soul into the world in order to explain the world in a spiritual way. Instead, they will say, we first attempt, cautiously and seriously, to inwardly penetrate man, and there will then be revealed to us the cosmos, just as when we look at memories, the sum of personal experience reveals itself. Such things may appear paradoxical to contemporary consciousness, and yet this consciousness is on the way to apprehending them. There is a longing to follow up certain lines of thought that are already there. When people do so, a certain amount of practice is, of course, required. The thoughts that lie along these lines will develop more and more into living thoughts. And when, in addition to this, the will has been developed, people will enter increasingly upon this kind of self-knowledge and see that while on the one hand the continual advance of the self into the outer world leads to self-knowledge, penetration into the depths of human nature leads outward from man to knowledge of the world. In order to cultivate a disinterested approach to these matters, it is necessary to look at human nature in a way that is different from that usually adopted today. People today dissect the human bone system, muscular system, and nervous system, and take the results as a definition of his physical being. They can then envisage man as if he were a creature of solid material constituents. Yet everyone today knows that essentially man is not made up of solid constituents. For the most part, some 90%, in fact, he is a column of water. Everyone today knows that the air I have just breathed in was previously outside in the world, and that the air I now have functioning within me will later be outside once more and belong to the world. And finally, everyone can comprehend that the human organism has a continuous exchange of heat. When we look at man in this way, we gradually escape the illusion of our solidity. We recognize it as an illusion, and yet we cling to it in our soul, as if man could be viewed in the way we depict him in anatomy. With equal justification, we shall come to regard the liquid in man as part of his being, what vibrates, surges, and creates in the fluid human being. We shall come to perceive that what takes place in the air form of man also belongs to his being. And finally, we may come to comprehend that the air inside us that vibrates, surges, moves up and down, diffuses itself through the currents in our veins and functions within us, is warmed in some places and cooled in others. The sole spiritual element that we carry within us today, in this more or less abstract form, suffers from a marked image character, so that we can really only perceive it from within, as we say. Nor can we escape from this perception from within by looking at what physiology and anatomy tell us about man. All the magnificent results that ordinary science has achieved present us with a solid shape of complex structure, yet it is one quite different in kind from what we observe within us when we visualize our thinking, feeling, and willing, and we cannot find a bridge from one to the other. We can watch the struggles of psychologists to establish a relationship between what they comprehend in its abstractness and image character, the only way that is open to their inward perception, and what exists outside. The two things are so far apart that we cannot establish a connection between them directly through ordinary consciousness. But if we proceed without prejudice and fix our gaze not upon an illusion of the solid human being, but upon man as a being of liquid, a being of air and heat, then by feeling our way into our own selves, we shall become aware of the flow of heat and cold in the currents of our respiratory circulation, if we provide an inner basis on which we can do so. We can reach such a basis by the path of higher knowledge, as I have tried to describe it in the last 2 days. In learning to apprehend the air that vibrates inside us, we remain, more or less, within the physical realm. But when we apprehend it and then transfer the living thinking that senses something of reality within, the bridge is established for us. And if we become aware of the human being down to the details of his temperature variations and condense the soul element until, out of its abstractness, it attains true reality, then we shall find the bridge. Condensed in this way, the life of the soul can link itself with rarefied physical experience. When we begin to penetrate ourselves and thereby perceive how living thought moves in our, in quotes, air man, if I may so express myself, in which there are certain temperature variations, we gradually see how, in fact, differences of thought can also operate in our human organism. Thus a sympathetic thought, for example, the verdict, quote, yes indeed, the tree is green, close quote, does in fact induce a state of heat. Whereas a thought in which antipathy is present, a negative judgment, for example, has a chilling effect on our air, heat, materiality. In this way, we see how the soul element continues to vibrate and create through finer materiality into denser materiality. We find it possible to direct our path of knowledge into the human organism, too, in such a way that we start with the soul and go on into the material. This, in turn, makes it possible for us to advance further and further toward what I have just been describing, an inner knowledge of the human organism. For the soul will not unveil itself to us until we can trace the various levels of materiality, water, air, and fire, in the individual organs. We must first condense the soul element. Only then will we reach man's physical nature and come in turn by passing through this to the spiritual basis of our physical organism. Just as when we drill into ourselves with the aid of memory, we discover the laid-up experiences of our individual existence on earth, so too, in thus descending into the whole human being, we find the spiritual element that has come down from the spiritual world through conception, fetal development, and so on. In clothing itself in us, with what it acquires from the earth, this spiritual element becomes world memory. We find the cosmos stored up as recollection within us, and we thus find it possible, exactly as in ordinary consciousness we can remember the individual experience of personal existence, to survey the cosmos through inner vision. You will perhaps ask, yes, but when we get back to very early states of the earth, by means of this world memory, how can we avoid the danger of a general description of spirit usurping the concrete world recollection? Once again, we only need to make a comparison with ordinary memory. Because our memory is well ordered, we will not, in feeling some 10-year-old experience float to the surface, refer it to events that have only just taken place. The content of the memory itself helps us to date it correctly. Similarly, when we understand our organism aright, we find that each of its separate parts points to the relevant moment in world evolution. Essentially, what natural science produces theoretically by extending its observations from the present back into earlier ages can only properly be completed by man's self-contemplation, which leads to a real world recollection, a world memory. Otherwise, we will always be condemned to fall into curious errors when we construct hypothetical theories of world evolution. What I am about to say may sound trivial, but it will illustrate my point. The so-called Kant-Laplace theory, now, of course, modified, the theory of how the individual bodies in the solar system split off from a nebula in the universe, is commonly illustrated by taking a drop of oil, making a hole in a circular piece of card, fastening a pin through it, and rotating the drop of oil by means of the pin. Individual droplets separate off and continue to revolve round the main drop. A miniature solar system forms. And from the standpoint of the ordinary scientist, one can say, the same thing on a larger scale took place out there in space. But something else is also true. Anyone demonstrating something like this to illustrate the origin of our solar system would have to take all the factors into account. He would thus have to take into account the teacher standing there and rotating the drop of oil. He would have to place an enormous teacher out in space to rotate the cosmic nebula. This point, however, has been forgotten in the experiment I have described. Elsewhere in life, it is a very fine thing to forget oneself, but in an experiment, in illustrating important and serious problems, one must not forget such things. In this case, one must not forget oneself. Well, the worldview I am advocating does not forget these things. It accepts what is justified in natural science, but it also adds what can be seen in the spirit. And here, of course, we do not find an enormous person, but rather a spiritual world, which has to be placed into the material development. We thereby permeate the Kant-Laplace primal nebula, which perhaps rightly has been posited, with the spiritual beings and forces operative in it. And we permeate what will become of the earth in the so-called heat death, of which contemporary science speaks, with spiritual beings and forces. After the heat death, these will then carry the spiritual element out into other worlds, just as the spiritual element in man is carried out into other worlds when the body disintegrates into its earthly elements. In this way, we attain something significant for our time. I have demonstrated, I think, that what is ordinarily apprehended only in abstract cognition, the soul spiritual element, which one cannot bring near the material, is spiritually infinitely far removed from matter. What has followed from this for our entire cultural life? Because in ordinary consciousness we are unable to bring the spiritual near the material, we have a purely material view of the world's history. We form concepts of a purely physical process, with a beginning conceived in purely physical terms, in accordance with the laws of mechanics, and an end conceived in accordance with thermodynamics, as the heat death of the earth. At the same time, we are aware of ourselves as human beings, standing inside this process, and evolving from it in a way that is certainly unintelligible to contemporary science. If we are honest, however, we have to admit that we can never connect our soul experience with what goes on outside in the material sphere. And at this deepest level of the soul, interwoven with our thinking, feeling, and willing, are moral impulses and religious forces. They live within us, in the soul spiritual element, we cannot bring near the material. And so, perhaps, the modern person, with his consciousness being what it is, says to himself, natural science leads us only to a material process. This alone makes up exact science. For moral impulses and religious forces, we require notions of faith. This view, however, is incompatible with the serious life of the soul. And in their unconscious minds, serious people today feel, though they may not admit it, that the earth has evolved from the purely material. From this emerges a kind of bubble. There arise cloud formations, and indeed shapes thinner even than clouds, mere illusions. In these exists the greatest content we can absorb as human beings, all the content of culture. We go on living for a while, and then one day the earth enters into its heat death, which can be foretold on the basis of external scientific evidence. At this point, it is as if all life on earth is buried in an enormous cemetery. The most valuable things that have arisen from our human life, our finest and noblest ideals, are buried alongside what was the material substance of the earth. You can say you don't believe it, but anyone who reacts honestly to what is often thought about these things today by people who reject independent spiritual research cannot avoid the inner dissonance and pessimism that arise in face of the question, what is to become of our spiritual activity if we regard the world in a purely material sense, as we are accustomed to do in exact science, as it is called? This is the origin of the wide gulf that yawns in our time between religious and moral life and the natural approach to things. It seems to me that given these circumstances, a genuine seership, an exact seership, is called for, one suited to modern man, in order to establish a bridge between spiritual and material, by providing a basis of reality for the spiritual and taking from the material its coarseness, as I would call it. That is above all what we bring before our souls when we look at things as we have done today. We have seen the spiritual in the human being himself, gradually passing over into his human heat and air variations, by descending into the coarser material sphere, and seeing how the finer element flows into living thinking. We shall be able to think our way into the cosmos, and understand correctly something like the heat death of the earth. Because we know how our own human heat in its differentiation is permeated by living thinking. And from the standpoint of the world memory that appears within us, we can look at what is spiritually active in the material processes of the world. In this way, we arrive at a real reconciliation between what presents itself to us spiritually and what presents itself to us materially. True, there is much in people's hearts today that still speaks against such a reconciliation. For, in recent centuries, we have grown accustomed to call truths exact only when they rest upon a solid basis of sensory observation, in which we surrender, passively, to the outer world. What has been observed on this kind of solid basis is then built up into natural laws and natural theories. And theories are accepted as valid only when they rest upon this solid basis of sensory observation. Those who think like this resemble people who will only consider ordinary gravity to be valid in cosmic space, and who say, quote, the earth has its gravity, and bodies must fall toward the earth, and have a support because they cannot float about freely in space, close quote. This is true so long as we are standing on the earth, and considering the earth's gravity in relation to its immediate surroundings. But if we look out into space, we know that we cannot say, quote, the heavenly bodies must be supported, close quote, but must say, quote, they support one another, close quote. We need to attain this attitude in a form appropriate to the spirit for our inner universe of knowledge. We must be capable of developing truths that specifically do not require the support of sensory perception, but support one another, as do the heavenly bodies in space. This is, in fact, a precondition for the attainment of a real cosmology, one that is not made up simply of material processes, but in which the material is shot through with soul and spirit. And such a cosmology is needed by modern man. We shall see how he needs it even for his immediate social tasks. But not until we perceive how the really significant truths support one another will we understand how we can penetrate to a cosmology of this kind. Such a cosmology results when we accept as valid the way in which true self-knowledge is attained. We do not attain it anthropomorphically by going out into the universe with our own experience of self. Rather, by immersing ourselves in the outer world, we experience more and more what our I, capital, is, and thereby achieve self-knowledge. When we dive down into our inner being, however, our inner being becomes world memory, and we learn world knowledge. Many people already sense the nature of the secret pertaining to knowledge of the world. I would like to express in two sentences what they divine. Self-knowledge and world knowledge must be truths that mutually support each other. And of this nature, moving to and fro in a pendulum motion, are the truths that are attained by the view of the world and of life I am here describing, as self-knowledge and as world knowledge. The two sentences in which I would like to sum this up are the following. If you would know yourself, seek yourself in the widths of the world. If you would know the world, penetrate your own depths. Your own depths will reveal to you, as in a world memory, the secrets of the cosmos. The end of Lecture 5.